Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
This week, Congress gave final approval to a massive farm bill. This hour, highlights of the bill's agriculture and food programs. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also this hour, more developments in the Nate Bolton sexual harassment complaint, why the cost of our state's children's health insurance program is set to soar, Iowa Supreme Court tackles collective bargaining, and a new documentary film that recounts how Collins Radio of Cedar Rapids was a key to communications in the space race. Buckle up for your News Buzz. First, this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, this week, after months of debate and negotiation, Congress voted final approval to a massive farm bill, providing more than $400 billion for agricultural subsidies, conservation programs, food aid. We'll cover some of the highlights of the new farm bill, setting federal agricultural and food policy for the next 5 years with IPR's Amy Mayer later in the program. But to start, let's check in with our new IPR Statehouse reporter, Katarina Sestarek. Hi, Katarina.
Hi, Ben.
I see from your reporting, that State Senator Nate Bolton, a Democrat from Des Moines, is back in the news. Tell us about it.
Yes. So in November, a lawyer named Sharon Wegner filed a complaint with the Senate Ethics Committee. It's related to sexual harassment allegations that were brought up before the Democratic primary for governor. If people remember, Senator Bolton had to drop out of that race because three women accused him of sexual harassment and sexual misconduct. So Sharon Wegner, a lawyer in Des Moines, she filed a complaint with the Senate Ethics Committee saying that in 2015, Bolton followed her around at two bars and kept putting his hand on her butt. She kept trying to move away from him, she says, but he kept following her and doing that over and over again.
Mm-hmm. And does this complaint have any evidence aside from what she says?
One of her friends signed an affidavit saying that she saw Bolton touch Wegner's butt that night.
Mm-hmm. And what has been Nate Bolton's response?
His response has multiple parts. So he just filed his response on Monday, which is kind of the first long extended response we've seen from him about this incident. It has multiple parts. He's asking the Ethics Committee to dismiss the complaint, first of all, because he says it happened, the allegations come from before he was a senator. So he's saying the Senate Ethics Committee should not be able to investigate a complaint that did not take place while he was a senator. He also says the Senate Code of Ethics doesn't apply to conduct that's unrelated to the workplace, so that these allegations, he says, if true, don't even actually violate the Senate Code of Ethics. And his third point is that he just says he has no memory of the incident, but he also says that he's struggled with alcohol in the past, so he can't say for certain that he never touched Wegner that night. But his response also brings up a lot of emails and conversations with Wegner from before and after the alleged incident to show that they sort of communicated and would meet about work and campaign-related things. They were both in the same field of work.
Mm-hmm.
It also brings up that she liked and retweeted Bolton's social media posts. And there's also an affidavit from another lawyer who's one of Bolton's coworkers saying that Wegner was overly flirtatious with Bolton at an event about a month before the alleged incident. And with all that, I just think it's important to say that none of those things prove or disprove Wegner's complaint.
Mm-hmm. I guess a question here, and I know you touched this on your reporting, is why Wegner, who made the complaint here, why she waited to bring up this complaint?
Well, she wrote in her complaint that she perceived Bolton to have a lot of power in the community and in their shared profession. She said she was afraid that saying something could hurt her career.
So what does this all have to say about the career, the political career of Nate Bolton going forward?
Senate Democratic leader Janet Peterson has called on him to resign months ago. That's sort of, you know, kind of his boss in the Senate. She didn't assign him to any legislative committees. She said she would defer until the Ethics Committee is done considering the complaint against him. At least the way things currently stand, it's hard to see how he could be an effective senator. And the more news stories there are about this, that can't really be positive for him in the future.
Okay. And so going forward, we have a Senate Ethics Committee meeting scheduled?
Yes, that's scheduled for December 20th. The committee, which is an equal number of Republicans and Democrats, they'll decide what to do with this complaint. And there are lots of things that they could do, ranging from just dismissing the complaint to even having the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court appoint a special counsel to investigate.
Okay, we'll watch the story and listen for your reporting, Katarina. You are taking the helm as IPR's new State House reporter after the retirement of Joyce Russell. The next legislative session starts in January, and we'll be working together, especially on Mondays, for Legislative Mondays on River to River. Can you give us a quick preview of what to expect for the new session?
I think it'll just be interesting to see if Governor Reynolds, now that she's been fully elected to a full term, to see if she sort of takes a different approach to the governorship than she did last year, and also just to see what Republicans will do with their continued hold on the House and Senate. There's talks of, perhaps a constitutional amendment related to gun rights, also to perhaps more corporate tax cuts. There are a lot of things. There's even been some talk about the 3/8 cent sales tax for water quality. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens in January.
Okay, we're looking forward to it. IPR State House reporter Katarina Sestarek. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks to everyone who contributed to our year-end fundraiser. We know you rely on IPR for honest reporting, insightful conversations, real journalism. That's so important to Iowa Public Radio. It's been a mainstay of Iowa for nearly 100 years in our broadcast history. We can tell you, no matter what happens in the next century, we'll be there for you to inspire, report, and entertain. And we can do it all because of your support. So at the end of this year-end fundraiser, we want to thank you very much for your support and wish you happy holidays, of course. Let's continue with this News Buzz edition of River to River. The cost of children's health insurance in Iowa, the health insurance program, is set to soar over the next couple of years because of changes approved by Congress that reduce federal funding. The Healthy and Well Kids in Iowa, HawkEye is the acronym it goes by, is offered through the National Children's Health Insurance Program, known as CHIP. That was started back in 1997 under President Clinton. Let's hear about this update from Ann Disher, Executive Director of the Child and Family Policy Center in Des Moines. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Ben. Happy to be here.
So tell us, what has happened? How much is this increase?
Well, as you mentioned, the federal government is going to be rolling back part of an enhanced federal match rate that they provided to states to help cover the cost of state CHIP programs. And so I was looking at having to pony up more of the cost of that program, which is, I think, around $7 million this year and about $37 million more than they're paying right now.
Mm-hmm. So no small change. How did this happen? Why did this happen?
Well, the federal government, the Congress, agreed to extend CHIP early this year. And it was a nice long-term extension, which we know is really good for Iowa kids. But as part of the agreement to extend that program, they declined to extend that enhanced match rate. And so although the federal government will actually still be providing a pretty significant share of CHIP funds, even when that enhanced match rate is gone, the federal government will still be paying 75% of the costs. That does put of the responsibility on our state.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk about it from a state level, and then for Iowans, listeners who may be depending on HawkEye for health insurance, the state budget. So our elected state officials are paying attention to this. So what does it mean for the state budget?
Well, actually, Iowa lawmakers don't have a huge amount of options here. Federal rules greatly limit states' ability to change CHIP enrollment and eligibility standards. So there might be a little wiggle room around the margins, but for the most part, Iowa cannot reduce costs for Hawkeye by cutting kids from the program. So really, the effect is that it will squeeze essentially other parts of our state budget, which of course is a concern. But it probably doesn't have a whole lot of effects on CHIP coverage.
Mm-hmm. So when you say squeeze other parts of the budget, is it clear which parts will be squeezed in this sort of knock-on?
Well, I think that's for lawmakers to determine, right? Mm-hmm. And one thing I will put in some context, that, you know, Iowa has a $7 billion state general fund. So this change represents like a pretty modest bump in the scheme of things. It's like less than 0.5% of the total general fund and something like 2% of the Health and Human Services budget. So I do want to put it in context, right? But having said that, our state also passed fairly significant tax cuts in the last legislative session. And as I think we heard, there's interest in possibly passing more. So in that environment, even more modest cost increases start mattering a lot more.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's take Iowans. How many Iowans depend on this or in some way connected to Hawkeye through CHIP?
Yeah. CHIP, I will tell you right up front, we have an institutional bias here at our shop in favor of CHIP. We think it's such a valuable program. It covers about 74,000 low and moderate income Iowa children. And those are kids, CHIP was designed for and still really serves kids whose families make a little bit too much for Medicaid, but not enough to either afford or have access to private insurance. So it's for, you know, generally working families, again, where they can't afford or get access to private insurance, that mm-hmm. gap between Medicaid and private coverage.
Mm-hmm. So low to moderate, can you throw out for, I guess, the typical family is a family of four, which we talk about, right? So what incomes are we talking about?
Let's see. It actually can be, it's pretty generous. I think incomes up, I want to say close to $70,000 a year. Now, to get on CHIP, you have to have been uninsured. Right? So
mm-hmm.
this is catching kids. This isn't catching kids who are moving off of private plans. This is catching kids who likewise would otherwise go uncovered.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you, the thing we know about CHIP is that kids who, and well, one thing that we know nationally about numbers, in 1997, when the program was first initiated, about 23% of children with family incomes just above the poverty level, right? That group.
Mm-hmm.
Who weren't eligible for Medicaid, but 1 in 4 of them were uninsured when that program started. By 2015, just 7% of kids in that group were uninsured. That's really, there's multiple reasons, but a great portion of that is because of the accessibility of CHIP. We know that kids who have health insurance are much more likely than peers who don't to get needed health care, preventive mm-hmm. care, right? They're much less likely to have avoidable hospitalizations. They miss less school, right, because their health is better managed, and that puts them on track to go on and have higher rates of high school graduation and college enrollment. Like, CHIP is a really great deal for our state, and even though we're going to be on the hook for a slightly higher share of it, it's kind of a no-brainer of an initiative. And I will say that's why CHIP traditionally has had, both at the state and federal levels, bipartisan support.
Mm-hmm. So the change in Congress with the Democrats going into the House, do you expect that will matter in this area?
I don't think so. I'll tell you what, child advocates and health advocates were really thrilled to get a long-term extension of that program, right, because it provides stability, provides certainty for families. And so I think we would have loved to have seen that enhanced match rate go on, mostly because it's good for states, right? It gives states more flexibility. But I think given the certainty that it brings, I don't think anyone's real interested in reopening the CHIP program at the federal level.
Mm-hmm. Because this involves health insurance, I have to ask, does this have anything to do with the Affordable Care Act, the ACA, and its fate over the last few years?
Well, you know, it that enhanced rate that we're talking about, right, that's now going away, that actually was part of the Affordable Care Act originally, and that enhanced match rate kicked in about 4 or 5 years ago. So, you know, ultimately states are going back to the funding level of CHIP that they used to have. But that still feels like a squeeze, obviously, when states have gotten used to having more federal support for the program.
Mm-hmm. Okay, just to reiterate before we say goodbye, Anne, anything else important here, but to reiterate, too, for those who are, we don't want to alarm people unnecessarily, parents of kids who are being helped along by Hawkeye, the message for them is this will go on as usual.
Absolutely. The federal, by participating in CHIP, states have to comply with federal rules. And federal rules right now say states can't start making big coverage cuts. So we do not expect that that is how the state is going to solve this problem at all.
Okay. Ann Disher, thank you for catching us up on this bit of news. Executive Director of the Child and Family Policy Center in Des Moines. We appreciate your time, Ann, and your expertise.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, some of Iowa's largest public employee unions argued before the Iowa Supreme Court this week, that was on Wednesday, that a 2017 law that rewrote the state's collective bargaining laws was unconstitutional in that it favored certain workers. Joining us to talk about it, Paul Iverson. He's a labor educator at the Labor Center at the University of Iowa. By the way, the mission of the Labor Center at the UI is to provide educational programs and research support to Iowa's working people and their organizations. Paul Iverson, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So set the scene. The Iowa Supreme Court heard a case today. What is the case and how did it come before the court?
Well, as you were saying, there were major changes to the public sector bargaining law in 2017. It was a law that had been in existence since 1974 and had worked very well. Most negotiations were settled without going to arbitration, and there were no strikes during that period. But in 2017, the legislature decided that they needed to make changes to it and made wholesale changes, including defining public safety employees and treating them differently than other employees, and also making it illegal for employers to deduct union dues from employees' pay, even if they have given their authorization to do so, but still allowing United Way or YMCA or some other sort of deductions. Employers allow all sorts of deductions, but it made one type of deduction illegal. So after that was passed in 2017, AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and the ISEA, the Iowa State Iowa State Education Association, excuse me, mm-hmm. Both sued separately in district court, claiming some things that are similar and some things that are a little different. Both of them say that making that distinction of public employees, but carving out other public safety employees and other non-public safety employees and treating them differently violates the Iowa Constitution, specifically Section 6, which is the Equal Protection Clause, that says the General Assembly shall not grant to any citizen or class of citizens privileges or immunities which upon the same terms shall not equally belong to all citizens.
Mm-hmm. And so, So for the backers of this new law and those arguing against those who brought this case, what would be the rationale for treating some differently than others?
Well, that was one of the problems that the state faced in oral argument. The state basically had to concede that there was nothing in the record that gave any rational basis for what they were doing. But they were saying that, well, the idea is there a rational basis? Could you come up with a reason that would be rational, even though the legislature did not state that reason?
Hmm.
So the state basically conceded that you couldn't tell from the legislation what rationale there was because it was just an arbitrary distinction that they made to try to divide public employees. One of my favorite little bits was Supreme Court Justice using the the blind hog analogy, saying even a blind hog finds an acorn once in a while, but AFSCME got no acorns in this bill.
Okay. So the court heard oral arguments, the Iowa Supreme Court. Depending on the way the decision goes, what could be the impact of how the court rules here?
Well, the cases were initially dismissed by the district court, so that left the statute intact. But it's been on appeal to the Supreme Court, and now the Supreme Court is being asked to find the law invalid because it is unconstitutional because of those distinctions. And so if the Supreme Court rules in favor of the unions, then much of the 2017 legislation will be void.
Mm-hmm. We often talk about this with the U.S. Supreme Court, that you can tell conservative justices from more liberal justices. Is there any way of knowing, based on the reports of the oral arguments, the arguments presented here, and the makeup of our Iowa Supreme Court, which way this court will decide?
I'm a lawyer by training. I've given up long ago trying to predict what courts will do.
Right.
The court showed a lot of skepticism over the particularly 30. If a unit has 30% public safety employees, it gets more bargaining rights than others. And so, if public safety employees happen to be in a unit where they're only 25% of the unit, they don't get any of the rights that other public safety employees. And they were very skeptical about that and asked some tough questions on that. But it's really hard to read from that how they might actually rule.
Mm-hmm. Iowa, in this acting this law in 2017, is Iowa following in the footsteps of other states as well?
Yeah. Well, this is part of a national program of the American Legislative Exchange Council, of which all Republican legislators in Iowa are members. So yes, this is something that's more part of a national program. It's not something that, you know, was thought up in Iowa. Then Governor Branstad said that he was inspired by Scott Walker and what he did in Wisconsin. So, you know, this was not something that is tailored to Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so to close here, those listening, who might be impacted most depending on this decision? Who should have their ears perked up waiting for a decision from this court? Who could be potentially impacted?
Well, all public employees in the state of Iowa could be impacted by this decision. And so it could return us to more of the way the statute worked before 2017. So all of your teachers and snowplow drivers and DMV employee, everybody in the state will be affected. And particularly, you know, the correctional officers at prisons that were not considered public safety employees, it'll be a big difference for them if they can negotiate over health and safety, something that was taken away from them.
Okay, very good. A very involved topic. You've made it accessible to us. Thank you, Paul Iverson, labor educator at the Labor Center at the University of Iowa, talking about some background on the news that the Iowa Supreme Court heard oral arguments about a law, 2017. We've reported on it many times, rewriting the state's collective bargaining laws. And the claim here that it unconstitutionally favors certain workers. Paul, thanks for unraveling that for us.
Thank you.
When we come back, we continue with our News Buzz edition of River to River. This week, Congress gave final approval to a massive farm bill. We'll hear about highlights of the bill's agriculture and food aid programs from Amy Mayer. Also, a new documentary film that recounts how Collins Radio of Cedar Rapids was a key to communications in the space race. It's a News Buzz edition. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, it was a debate that took months. Funding for the food stamp program, one of the major sticking points during all of the negotiations. But this week, Congress passed a 5-year farm bill that would reauthorize a variety of agricultural programs, also food aid for low-income Americans. Now the bill heads to the president's desk. He's expected to sign it next week. Amy Mayer is with us, reporter for Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Ben.
Quickly, before we get into some of the highlights, what finally broke the impasse after these long negotiations?
I think there were a few factors. One is that the Republicans had a real incentive to get it done before the change in Congress because of the House shifting to Democratic control in the next Congress. Also, the Republicans in the House managed to sway some of their harder line colleagues who were really pushing for some stricter requirements for the SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, and that sort of broke through.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's start there when you walk us through some of the highlights there. SNAP, this is nutrition assistance, better known as food stamps, right? So what's new here?
Sure. In the House, they had a debate about whether they wanted to make more intense their work and job training requirements for able-bodied adults without kids who were eligible for the program. In the first go-round in the House, this was a big sticking point, although it was not ultimately the reason that the Farm Bill did not pass on its first try in the House. Later, when the House passed its bill, it had these stricter work requirements, which were a showstopper in the Senate. So on the Senate side, it was sort of always understood, even by Republicans who supported that provision, that a farm bill with that provision wasn't going to make it through the Senate.
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, a variety of agricultural programs reauthorized here. What jumps out at you as highlights under that category?
Well, one of the most important things for our farmers here in Iowa is that there's a program called Agricultural Risk Coverage, which was new in the 2014 Farm Bill. It's only been a little bit tweaked in this bill, but it's paired with a program called Price Loss Coverage. And under the 2014 bill, when these programs were new, a farmer had to choose one and stick with it for the life of the Farm Bill. Now, under the 2018 Farm Bill, there will be an annual sign-up, and if farmers want to switch between those two, they'll be able to each year.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so how did our congressional delegation weigh in or shape this Farm Bill?
Senator Ernst is quite supportive. There were a number of things in it that she had been pushing for. One of the key things she highlighted in a call with reporters is her Farmers First Act, which is a program that will help provide more support for rural mental health services and suicide prevention. In addition, Senator Ernst had been an advocate for certain modifications to conservation programs. On the other hand, Senator Grassley has been pushing for the past three farm bills for payment limitations. In other words, a system that would reduce the number of people per farm eligible for federal support. And that did not make it into the final bill. Senator Grassley voted against the farm bill for that reason.
Oh, he voted against the farm bill.
That's right.
Mm, okay.
And he's one of, I think, only two farmers in the Senate. So he's really trying to send a message with that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What else do you count as highlights here?
This farm bill removes industrial hemp from the list of Schedule I controlled substances. It was categorized as a drug. Now it will not be, and it will be considered just any other crop. This is the plant that does not contain the ingredient in marijuana that gives you a high. It is a completely separate plant, although they're related. And now people who want to grow industrial hemp will be allowed to. They'll be eligible for all of the standard banking and loan programs, and they will even be eligible for federal crop insurance, just as other commodity farmers are.
Yeah, hemp itself is an interesting history, isn't it, that it got mixed up with the illegalization of marijuana as a related plant, right? It's been decades that we've had it on our blacklist.
Right, and it's interesting because as marijuana has become approved for medical uses in many states and even for recreational uses in some states, that tends to be associated with pretty liberal jurisdictions. But it was actually Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell from Kentucky, not considered one of the more liberal jurisdictions, who wanted industrial hemp to be in the farm bill and made a standard commodity. And it was his leadership that really ensured that industrial hemp got this reprieve.
Mm-hmm. I see in the highlights that this expands the safety net for dairy farmers as well, the new farm bill.
Yes, and this is another important change from the 2014 bill. They did put a program in the 2014 farm bill that was intended to help dairy farmers, and it was widely considered to be ineffective. It just, the way it set different numbers, it didn't particularly work in the actual economy. So they've tried to make some provisions to that so that dairy farmers will get some a little bit more relief, especially as things have been really tough for dairy farmers of late. And actually, Senator Ernst mentioned something else specific to dairy, which is that there's a provision connected with the nutrition programs that will provide incentives for people using SNAP benefits to buy more dairy products, which then, of course, cycles back to the demand and helps the farmers with filling that need.
Mm-hmm. Organics are all the rage in our stores. There's funding for organics here as well, aren't they?
There has been funding for organics in the past few farm bills, and that does continue. It's a part of what some supporters of sustainable agriculture consider some of the smaller ticket items in the farm bill, but that get a real big bang for those bucks. Organic supports, also programs that help people begin farming, or veteran farmers, people who maybe in the past have not had access to some federal programs, such as socially disadvantaged groups. So some of those organic supports, local food supports, and beginning farmer rancher development programs will all be sustained. Some of them will become permanent under the new farm bill as well. So those are considered victories.
Mm-hmm. And for those of our listeners listening in rural areas and lacking high-speed internet, there's a bump up in funding for that to rural communities, isn't there?
There is. There's a whole title in the farm bill called Rural Development, and it does a lot of different programs, especially for rural infrastructure. This question of rural connectivity is something USDA has been looking at over the past several years. There will be some more funding to help improve that. Similarly, they had thought about cutting, but I think ultimately kept some of the loan programs to help small communities improve their water systems or wastewater systems and things like that, that are essential necessities, but in a small population density area, they cost a lot more per taxpayer. And so mm-hmm. those are areas where rural development funding can come in and help ease that burden.
Mm-hmm. Did we leave anything out before we say goodbye on the your list of the takeaways of the farm bill?
I think one of the things that struck me is that when we started reporting on this bill in January, knowing that the farm bill would be expiring September 30th, I talked to several people who have been monitoring the farm bill for years and asked them, is this going to be a 2018 bill, a 2019 bill? I had someone tell me he was thinking 2020 because the 2012 farm bill didn't actually happen until 2014. But it looks like if the president signs this bill next week, we will have a 2018 farm bill. And that in some ways kind of exceeds expectations that a lot of people had for it.
All right, Amy, we'll keep our eyes on this new farm bill. 5-year farm bill passed this week by Congress, awaiting the president's signature. Amy Mayer, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. One small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. We all know these famous words from Neil Armstrong when he first descended the ladder of the Apollo 11 lunar lander, the module to set foot on the moon back in 1969. But did you know voices, all the voices that came back from space on the Apollo missions came from equipment produced by Collins Radio of Cedar Rapids? Well, a new documentary film celebrating Collins Radio premieres next week. It's titled Moon Talk. The film celebrates the men and women of Collins Radio, the company who had the vision beyond the technology available in the 1960s to create and manufacture a communication system to reach the moon.
A half century ago, men on board the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo space capsules talked to Earth, navigated in space and to the moon and back, and exchanged critical data with mission control. How was this accomplished 5 decades ago? By the ingenuity and dedication of a company founded in the heartland of America. The Collins Radio Company in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. The Collins Story, connecting the moon to the Earth, tells the little-known story of the people who designed the space communication systems and how they did it. These systems were technical feats that had never been done before and played a crucial role in America's race to be the first to land a man on the moon.
Every voice that ever came back from space came over Collins system.
The television broadcast of Neil Armstrong's first human step on the moon's surface also was made possible by Collins engineers.
That was a very moving moment in our lives, and to think we had something to do with it.
Okay, a little preview there for you of Moon Talk. 2 opportunities to see it free of charge. The public is invited to see it Friday, December 21st, 11 a.m. is when the doors open. It starts at 11:30 at Collins Road Theaters in Cedar Rapids. Then the next day, Saturday, December 22nd at Coe College, Their Sinclair Auditorium will show it in the evening, beginning at 7:30. Come early to get a seat. It's expected to be a popular event for people to turn out, especially in eastern Iowa, where Collins Radio is a big name. Now, latest name for Collins Radio, Collins Aerospace, a division of UTC. Joining me now, Rod Bloxam is project manager of this documentary, Moon Talk. He started with Collins, then Rockwell Collins. He's been there 42 years, an engineer, and now managing this film. Rod Bloxam, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ben. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us more about this documentary film. I mean, it's a little-known thing. We all know Neil Armstrong. Not a lot of people know that so much of the space program, critical parts of the space program, came right here from Iowa.
Yes, and one of the interesting things why it's so little known here locally was that Arthur Collins, the founder and president of the company, really didn't seek publicity. He was more about, let's get the technology and it'll speak for itself. So even back then, other than people that actually worked on the project, it really wasn't advertised a lot. But Collins played a huge role in developing the communications, not only on the space capsule, but the infrastructure on the ground, the ground large antennas, even shipboard systems and aircraft that mm-hmm. were involved in the whole mission.
Mm-hmm. So how did Collins Radio come to be selected?
Well, that's part of the story. This is a three-part episode. We're going to go back and do episode one, which will explore all of the technology projects that Collins did in the 50s and early 60s that sort of set the stage and equipped the company to qualify for these NASA contracts on Apollo.
Mm-hmm. So this is if I'm reading you right, this is sort of a trilogy, and this we're starting with episode two,
yeah,
chronologically.
Just like Star Wars, we start in the middle.
Who appears in the film? There's some interesting archival footage that people haven't seen before, right?
Yes, we've had access to very rare films that the company photographer took in the 1960s at Collins. We've digitized these and restored the color, and you'll see clips of those. We've interviewed people that are, you know, they're quite elderly now, and in fact, some of them have passed away since we interviewed them, but they actually worked on the project and kind of relate some of their experiences with the development.
Mm-hmm. I'm reading one of the quotes here put out on the release that came out of for this film. This is from Jim Westcott, Collins Radio Apollo Program Administrator, if I can read this quote.
That's correct.
The idea was to get the job done correctly, and I remember times we slept under tables at night because we had meetings in the morning. We knew if the communication failed, it was a good chance that some of them wouldn't get back, if not all of them, and that was on our mind almost all of the time. That makes me choked up just thinking about
yes.
the pressure that you're under.
There's some dramatic moments in this documentary, and mm-hmm. that's one of them, to hear Jim express their concern and dedication to getting it done correctly and with high quality. You know, it had to work. Their lives depended upon it.
Mm-hmm. So tell us, how did Collins Radio get its start here in Iowa?
Well, Arthur Collins basically started the company in the basement of his home during the early days of the Depression, 1933. Well, actually 1931, and then incorporated the company in 1933 with 8 employees and $25,000 in capital, which was a huge sum, you think about, mm-hmm. in 1933. And it grew steadily. World War II, of course, was a huge boost. The company went from 150 employees at the beginning of the war to 3,500 at the conclusion of World War II.
Mm-hmm. And if I'm remembering right from the preview that I saw online of this film, Arthur Collins had sort of a supernatural, maybe that's the wrong word, a way of sort of knowing the technology that the future would need?
Yes, that was, he basically was a genius in this field, and he studied relentlessly, and he could predict, people have, you know, and it bears out, what was going to be needed in 5 to 10 years, and he would start doing it right then. And he was right.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of examples of that mm-hmm. we'll show in the movie.
Part of the reason for making this film, for showing it, is to sort of embed the legacy of Arthur Collins on our memories, isn't it?
Yes, it's a fascinating story, and The Arthur A. Collins Legacy Association is a nonprofit organization we formed 4 years ago to document what the contributions to the society was of the company. And also, the secondary mission is kind of stimulate interest in the STEM subjects, you know. Most of us that were around in the 60s can relate to the space program as why we chose a career in engineering. So part of the story is to inspire the teenagers and college students of today to consider a STEM career.
Mm-hmm. Give me a memory from your early days as a young man when you were totally inspired by the space program.
Gosh.
What's one standout image you have? Maybe you.
Well, one of the very beginning, I was in high school in 1961 when they called everyone into the gymnasium. They set up a small television, and we watched live on a black and white TV Alan Shepard's launch into space. And that was a dramatic moment. I mean, it left an impression, and we followed the space program.
Right, Alan Shepard. Or orbiting the Earth? Or what was the accomplishment?
It was a suborbital, but it was the first human being to be launched on a rocket into space. And, you know,
precluding the Russians, even.
No, first American.
First American.
Yeah, the Russians. The Russians were actually into space with a human being first.
Okay.
Yuri Gagarin.
Yuri Gagarin, exactly. And this is interesting. You have such a wealth of knowledge about the history of Collins Radio and Collins Rockwell and now Collins Aerospace. You actually work on a you give tours at a museum that
yes.
is at
yes.
Collins Aerospace.
I and several other retirees volunteer our time to be docents at the company museum, and it's located there on the campus, and it's basically open every Wednesday with a volunteer docent from 11:30 to 1 p.m., and we give special tours when there's customers or other groups that, you know, especially school groups.
Members of the public are welcome to see.
Yeah, we just need to know ahead of time so we can get you visitor passes.
Okay, very good. I want to make sure that others know about this this film that's to be premiered, Moonwalk, next Friday, December 21st at the Collins Road Theaters, Saturday, December 22nd at Coe College's Sinclair Auditorium on the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 8 mission. The Arthur A. Collins Legacy Association is presenting this documentary to celebrate the men and women of Collins Radio Company and their part in the space race. Fascinating. Rod Bloxham, Project Manager for Moonwalk, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Tony is with us, joining us from Iowa Public Radio's Studio One. Hi, Tony.
Hey, Ben. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you today?
I am great, and let's talk about some music.
Let's do, because we do need to. You know, we've had a news week that has always been, you know, lately rock and roll, leaving us maybe with some bruises with all the news that's coming. But we've just got done with what we think is a very successful fun drive. So let's rock into the weekend or groove into the weekend. What do you got for us?
For sure. Okay, we're going to start off with Charles Bradley. Charles Bradley, of course, great soul singer, got a fairly late start in his career, who also passed away in September of 2017. But his label Daptone has enough songs of his that were just kind of laying around that we got one more release from Charles Bradley. It's called Black Velvet, and the name of this album goes back to when Charles Bradley got his start. He was a James Brown impersonator earlier in his career, right around his 50s. And this album starts with this song, the Menahan Street Band, kind of the house band for Daptone. They backed Charles Bradley on this whole album. This is the song that gets it started. It's Can't Fight the Feeling.
Oh! Ah, yeah. Oh! Oh, baby. Can't fight the feeling, baby. Can't fight the feeling now. We got a sure thing together. Let's
Definitely hearing Tony Daner, some of the James Brown influence there with Charles Bradley.
Yeah, for sure.
Love that. What else you got to groove us into the weekend?
Some a little different. This is a duo from Chicago called Grape Tooth. A duo, Clay Frankel, who's also in the band Twin Peaks, who I think a lot of our Studio One listeners know, and his friend, a Chicago producer who goes by the name Homesick. They were living together for a while and just started making some music just for fun, as you do, and started playing some shows. Never thought this would become a thing. Well, here they are now. They've got a debut album out now on the Polyvinyl label, and some strong new wave vibes on this album. If you're into New Order or The Cure, you gotta check these guys out. This is Grape Tooth and one of the first singles from this album. It's called Violent.
Bit of Violent by Grape Tooth. Tony Daner, thanks so much, Studio One Tracks host. Remind us again how we can listen to Studio One Tracks.
Studio One Tracks is on 7 nights a week at 7 o'clock on our news Studio One stream. It also airs again at 7 o'clock the next morning on our 24-hour Studio One stream.
Tony Daner, thanks for grooving us into the weekend.
Anytime, Ben. Thank you.
River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.